Looking backward, looking forward. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be with you today. I have a little cold, so here's hoping my voice holds out for the entire program.
Well, I don't have a little cold, and if I get one, I'll know where I picked it up from. And I hope your voice does hold out, too. So I'm sorry to hear that. Well, folks, by the time you hear this, it will be 2015, and we'll be into January. The new year will have rung in, and hopefully by noon on Saturday when this program airs, you won't have already broken your New Year's resolutions if you made them. However, I know for some people that's easier said than done. I don't make resolutions for New Year's.
Yeah,
Chuck.
I quit doing that, too.
I just actually look back and say, okay, let me look at what I did in 2014. Okay, if it was good, I hope I keep doing more of it. If it was bad, I hope I quit doing it in 2015.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, it's one of those things where occasionally you run into those things that are so ingrained habits that are so bad that you think they're okay and they're not. You know, we're not going to go too far into detail here.
Okay, it's definitely. Now, if we had a call-in program, maybe we'd do that.
There you go. Yes, Dr. Chuck and Dr. Barry, we'll handle your problems.
That's
right,
sort
here
of like it. That Lucy Van Pelt thing. The doctor is in.
The doctor's in. Yeah. Yes. Well, psychiatrist 5 cents. That's about what it would be worth. About a nickel.
That's it.
So there you go. No, I quit making the resolutions a long time ago because, first of all, why? There are habits everybody needs to change. And when you set it as a form of a resolution, it basically sets up a failure, a kind of a cycle of, oh gosh, I failed at that. Well, that's it. I give up on everything else too.
Well, and also Charles, I think sometimes resolutions are promissory notes that people write to themselves, but they write it with invisible ink.
Yeah. Disappearing ink.
Disappearing ink. That's right. Not invisible, but a disappearing ink. Hopefully, it will disappear fat sooner rather than later.
Yeah, you have to hold it over a candle to be able to read it later.
And really, honestly, we can do nothing. We can resolve nothing in and of ourselves to change our condition. That's God working in us. That's the grace of the Holy Spirit. That is sanctification. Now, okay. Yeah, okay. Maybe I'm going to, eat a little less. Well, again, guess what? That's still, people want to call it willpower. No, it's whether or not you have a right relationship and right mental thinking and spiritual understanding of the forces that you're dealing with. I was just talking earlier today as we record this. Earlier today, I had a meeting. I was talking with a gentleman, and he had a very good perspective on this. He's like, anything good that I do is all God, and anything bad that I do is all me. I said, well, that's true to a certain extent because that's our basic nature is that, we are born into original sin from our father,
right.
Adam.
Right.
That's the reason why resolutions don't work, Chuck, because without God in the picture, without committing and submitting to Christ and to the Holy Spirit, we can't change our condition. You can't change dead.
Oh, right. And see, it's interesting you bring that up because now, just so everybody knows, last week's show, folks, because I didn't put an intro in the front that talked about what it was, that was our 2014 predictions that we made in January, the first week of January of 2014.
Now, back then, we said that we had something else planned, and we really hadn't planned to do this.
Right.
But we liked it so much that is what we've planned for
today. Yes, that's what we're planning for today.
We're going to be looking back at 2014 a little bit and looking forward to 2015.
Barry and I, for purposes of full disclosure, are going to tell you that we're both Calvinists. Think of us what you will on that, and we'd be happy to talk to you about that. Send us an email, and we'll discuss Calvinism versus whatever viewpoint you may have. That's fine.
We'll even discuss Hobbesianism, too, if you like the tiger better than the boy.
Yeah, there you go. And for those of you who don't get that joke, man, where have you been?
Well, Bill Watterson hasn't done that strip for probably a decade.
Yeah. That was a great one. Calvin and Hobbes, if you don't know what we're talking about. Look it up on the internet, Calvin and Hobbes. That being said, I have been helping out some individuals who are having some problems, and we began discussing that idea that we are dead in our sin. We're not wounded. We're not a little sick. We're not hanging on by our fingernails. We are dead. And the Bible is very clear that we are dead in our sin. And by dead, I mean completely spiritually dead. We have a heart of stone. And the yes. idea is that, I said it, until you understand it that way, you risk the danger of going back, and Barry already spoke about original sin. You risk the idea of going back and saying that original sin really doesn't exist. What you've got is, man is essentially good, but he's corrupted by society.
If he just tries really hard, he can fix his own condition.
Yeah. That is a form of Gnosticism, and it's a form of dualism. In other words, that the spirit is good and the physical is bad, and all we have to do is just be more quote-unquote spiritual, and eventually, if the spiritual part of us predominates, then we'll become as good as we can possibly be. And the fact is that what Calvinist doctrine says, and the Bible itself says, is that you are bad. Not as bad as you can possibly be, because that's what we get accused of if you know the acrostic TULIP, T-U-L-I-P, mm-hmm. Total Depravity, Unconditional Election, Limited Atonement,
Irresistible
Grace,
and the perseverance
of the Saints. Then you understand that the whole point is that utter depravity is not the same as total depravity. Total depravity means that every portion of your being is corrupted. Utter depravity means that every portion of your being is corrupted as badly as it can possibly be. In fact, it's completely rotted away. You know, there's an old saying that even Hitler and Stalin loved their mothers. Meaning that while they were very depraved, they were not utterly depraved. So there is a difference, and once you get into that idea, then you can understand what happens when you are given a new heart, a heart of flesh. Then you begin to understand you can't live a sinless life, but you can live a life in which you are constantly being, what's the word I'm looking for? Sanctified.
Oh, there you go.
Some Wesleyan people say that you are saved and sanctified. You will hear, I was saved and sanctified. Well, you are sanctified somewhat at the moment of your salvation, but you're not completely sanctified. Sanctification is an ongoing process.
Here's Theology 101.
Right.
Justification is once for all.
Yes.
Sanctification is ongoing, all, but not all at once.
Exactly. I like to think of it now. I tend to think scientifically because I'm trained as a scientist. So I think scientifically about this. It's a graph in which there's an asymptote. And if you know what that means, there's a limit. And the limit is 100%. You approach that limit, but in this lifetime, you never reach it. Not on this side of the veil. You can't get there. And unfortunately, there are some Christian beliefs that say you can live a sinless life. Well, if you want to take a 30-second place where you're unconscious, yeah, you can probably get there. But other than that, you know, for your entire life, it can't happen. Otherwise, Christ is not necessary. Because if you can live a sinless life, what do you need Jesus for? And I've asked that question of people who have given me that argument, and they say, well, to act as an example. Well, Christ is an example, but that's not why he came and died. He came and died to cover my sin.
Right.
that's one of the, I'm not sure how that ties in with what we're talking about, but it's an attitude about...
It ties in with remembering that in and of ourselves, we're going to fail. We're going to fail time and again. But yes. that doesn't But that isn't an indicator of our character. That's an indicator of our need for Christ.
Right. It's also a tie-in in how you view these things, because how you look at the world has a tremendous effect on how you act with the world.
Absolutely.
If you expect people, if you go in and expect people to be perfect, for instance, I don't know how many times I've seen this idea that someone we're going to get elected to office is going to save us. In fact, I saw something the other day from somebody who said, forget all these right wingers in Congress right now, and just hope that Elizabeth Warren saves us.
Oh my!
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Saves us from what? I guess from the free enterprise system. There is a dangerous trend to look messianically at politicians.
Mm-hmm. There is. And now it's funny because you and I, particularly Chuck, and our, shall we say, particular theological viewpoints.
Theological. That we have. There's that word again. By the way, I got compliments on that. People like that particular cut of phrase, and so do I. Theolytical.
Our theolytical viewpoint. People would say that's what they would accuse and charge us with that particular crime.
Yes.
Of thinking that all we have to do is get our people in and they will save us. The problem is, we're the last people. Our theological viewpoint is the last one that would ever assume that just putting the quote-unquote right people into an office and not fundamentally reconstructing the very nature of the entity itself and turning it over to one that honors God and is in line with his truth is going to do anything except add more problem and more corruption.
Exactly. As it has. Once you essentially assume that someone is going to do something, they're going to be this Messiah. And you can hear it in political pundits after Barack Obama was elected. And you could hear it also, believe it or not, after Richard Nixon was elected. If you remember, you may not be old enough, Barry. I'm old enough to remember this. What was the big saying about Nixon? Let Nixon be Nixon.
Yes.
And it was about Nixon was not a domestic policy president. He was a foreign policy president. So basically, they wanted him to appoint all these gurus to run domestic policy and to get it off his plate so he could run foreign policy. And the same thing can be said of Barack Obama, except that his acolytes were convinced he could do everything. And many of them still are, although that facade has more or less cracked away. Now suddenly you have people coming out who a year ago were saying he can do everything and are saying he can do nothing. Well, that's because they have, you know, how the Messiah has fallen. it's becoming clear that their trust in this human being, this fallible human being, was not well placed. And that's what we run into. Very often, conservatives will elect somebody who purports to be a conservative and then ignore what he does until it comes, and then suddenly, how come he went the wrong way on this bill? How come he's going the wrong way on this social issue?
Or why did the scorpion sting the frog halfway across the pond?
Yes, why did the scorpion sting the frog?
Because it's in his nature.
Yeah.
And that's the point. It's in all of our natures to look after our own self-interest, to, as my friend at lunch put it today, we get into groups, we thieve from each other. It's like, well, you know, I understand that. That's really a very refreshingly honest viewpoint on it. And the point is that outside of having a shared set of absolute values that are outside of you, and we've talked about this before, about,
right.
you know, the whole idea about, you know, mandating morality or legislating morality. No, you have to have something outside of you to act as a framework to operate in.
Right.
We can't live in a pure libertarian vision of Nobody has any bounds or limitations on them except what they want to set on themselves.
Right. And you run into major issues when you do that, because radical objectivism, which is what is the philosophical engine that powers radical libertarianism, is so individualistic that everyone else becomes completely secondary to the object, which is me. Mm-hmm. I'm the most important thing in the world. I am my own God, and everything has to work according to what I want, or I'm going to react in a negative way inside society. And that's why you see a lot of very odd things that, pardon me, I believe we're going to see because there is an upturn toward that particular type of philosophy, especially among the young. I think you're going to see the backlash from that coming in the next, let's put it this way, next year, and it will come out strongly in the election, in the 2016 election. And there's a lot of stuff happening in 2016, and that's not that far away.
No.
In fact, folks, we're going to start seeing the presidential campaign crank up, really crank up, in about February.
Oh, it's already started. It's already started. We're seeing it really crank up right now, Chuck. You have, especially on the Republican side, you have John Kasich traipsing around the country in pursuit of
I'm not running tour?
Yeah, the I'm not running tour of a balanced budget amendment.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's not kid ourselves. Jeb Bush is, I think I may look at trying to run for president. Oh, yeah, come and give me all these, accolades. We're seeing it already. Mitt Romney's coyness. Oh, Ann really doesn't want me to, but if the people really want me to.
Yeah, if you really want to draft me, believe me, nobody wants Mitt Romney to run for president.
Oh, don't kid yourself. There are people who want him to run for president, and their names are Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren. I can go down the list.
Well, unfortunately, it's also guys who are in charge of the Republican Party who really think they can get over the top this time with Romney. See what he did? He was so close last time. And it was just at the last minute all those conservatives pulled out. Well, believe me, you run Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney this time, you are basically going to see a Republican Party split along the lines of the Democratic Party split in 1860. And if you don't know about that, I'm not going to go into that. But let's put it this way. Abraham Lincoln got 39% of the votes, and all the Democrats who ran as splits got the other 61. So in other words, the Democrats who were more alike to each other and more different from Lincoln basically handed it to Lincoln.
Exactly.
By running against each other on what amount to minor points. So, when we get accused of that, splitting parties, there is a very wide ideological divide inside the Republican Party. There are people who want Republicans to be Democrat light, and there are people who want Republicans to be state sovereignty, constitutional conservatives. And right now, those are the guys who are getting shoved out of the party.
And that seems to be getting more and more prevalent these days. As a matter of fact, it's getting to the point where they're not even paying as much lip service anymore. They're really just out and out saying, yeah, we really don't need to be dealing with the social issues or the fringe fiscal issues. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. That's our 2015 predictions as we're coming up to them. I want to take a quick run and look back for a couple of moments at 2014. Now, folks, like I said, if you've been listening, you heard last week, those were our predictions at the end of 2013 going into 2014. We'll leave it to you to tell us how we did on that. What we can do is say there was a lot of things that were happening in 2014, not the least of which being a significant shift, at least in a number of states and at the congressional level, to a move away from the Democratic Party having control of the United States Senate, having a narrow majority in the minority in the United States House, and of course historic sweeps across the boards in the vast majority of states, as a repudiation of the current administration's policies and positions. Not really too big of a surprise. I mean, I think we all saw some of that coming, as it was developing over the last year, or actually last couple of years.
Right.
But I think some of the things that, again, we didn't see coming was how, and we saw this develop in the springtime, and we just mentioned it here just a moment ago, how the Republican Party seemed to be more than willing to attack their own, and to try to repudiate and or distance themselves as a party from the portion of their party that we lovingly call the Tea Party element, which really honestly is mainly constitutional conservatives who are, you know, fed up with the way things are going and the way the establishment is moving, and that they really were intent on making sure that the Tea Party element didn't get any traction. You know, there were a number of primaries, and they spent lots and lots of money on certain primaries to make sure that the Tea Party candidate lost, and that was both at the federal and the state level.
They spent wheelbarrows full of money to kill off the Tea Party candidates.
Yeah, basically, the only real big one you had was Bratt knocking off Cantor in Virginia, but that was more a function of Eric Cantor's being totally out of touch with his constituency and his district rather than Bratt being a stellar candidate for the Tea Party.
A mainstream Republican in a Tea Party district who basically managed to alienate the Tea Partiers in his district by A, never being there, and B, ignoring what they had to say.
Right.
And then expecting them to come out in droves and vote for him. That doesn't work.
Right. Now, I think another thing, and we didn't specifically touch on this one on point, but I think we did in the general feel of it. And I remember last year we talked about our culture, Chuck, and we talked about, and I think I particularly brought up this whole idea of how I found it, I think, understandable, disturbing, but understandable, that there was such a fascination in our culture with all things zombie.
Yes.
You know, from various television programs and movies and memes and other things out there about zombies and Walking Dead, and how that was kind of a touch point on what's going on in our culture. You know, we're basically moving to the point where many people just are reacting, for good or for bad, to what they're being fed, you know, to what they're being given. And they're just basically moving along in the society, and at some point, there had to have been a breaking point. Well, I honestly think that certain of our ethnic tensions that we have seen going around the country here toward the end of this last year is another point of that zombie society, the consequence of that zombie society mentality. You know, we've been fascinated with this whole concept, but we don't realize it. You know, we've been in a situation where we blindly accept, and we'll talk about this in another article that we'll run across here. We kind of blindly accept that, you know, police have all authority, right or wrong. We also blindly accept characterizations and stereotypes of everybody and individuals. We create an environment where entertainment and filling your own self esteem, I guess is the best way to put it, becomes job number one.
That's part of that whole radical libertarian objectivist.
Right, exactly.
That's a big part of it.
It's a big part of it. I mean, Michael Brown was probably somewhat of a poster child for the self-esteem movement.
Yeah.
However, if you take a look, many of the ways that police have handled these situations. Now, of course, in that case, you had a physical attack against the police officer that basically two grand juries now have, and independent investigators found, yeah, that's valid. But in other cases, I mean, in New York City, maybe even in the Cleveland situation, I think you had a situation where there was a tendency to react rather than think.
Yeah, there was a clearly.
I'm trying to put it in a way. I don't want to disrespect those folks who serve us in law enforcement, because there are many, many good people out there.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the problem. We're setting up into two very different camps when the real fact is we should all both be coming toward the center and saying, okay, are there problems in certain communities with a lack of respect for the police? And the answer is yes.
Absolutely.
Is there a problem in the police community where they're demanding too much respect and are overreacting with force? And the answer is yes. The fact is that in many cases, there are people who are drawn to police work, not all of them by any stretch of the imagination, but who are drawn to police work because they get to carry a club, a gun, and a taser, and they want to use them. There are other people who are in the police force to enforce the laws as fairly as they can do. They understand, you know, they get cynical because they see this bad stuff day in and day out. But they don't abuse. Most cops don't abuse their office.
The vast majority don't.
But the ones who do are, unfortunately, because of things like police unions, have interference run for them, and there is a brotherhood kind of a thing. It's a fraternal, and we need to stand up for them, even though they're clearly wrong in this case. They won't talk in those terms with us. They will talk amongst themselves. That's a dangerous place to be. I'm not too worried. My brothers will back me up. And you can see that in places where it's obvious that a policeman has grossly overreacted. And in a lot of these cases, for instance, the case in Cleveland that you brought up, and I think you brought this up to me, and I said, yeah, you're right. The problem is that the cops haven't really been on the job long enough to deal with it.
And that is a big problem right there, because if you think about it, in the Brown instance in Ferguson, I believe that the officer was under 5 years on the force and was by himself in a neighborhood where they already had a number of crime incidents.
Well, you and I go to St. Louis on occasion.
Yes, we do.
And we know that neighborhood.
Yes, we do.
We've driven through there.
Yes, we have.
Not at night.
No, we won't. not now, not ever.
Now, I don't claim to know it like the back of my hand, like the cops do.
Right.
Because that's their job. But the fact is, there are places where you and I wouldn't go at night. Those are rough areas. They're not nice. You know, those guys, you know, should one cop, I understand the idea that there's funding issues and you can cover a lot of territory in a car, but these kinds of things were far less in the days when cops walked a beat.
True.
But the population was much lower and people weren't quite, you know, they didn't have as much territory to cover with as few people. It's harder to have enough cops to walk a beat these days because of budget constraints. Well,
sure, absolutely.
Why are, you know, cities are getting more in tax revenues now than they ever have in the past, and yet what's the first place they cut when it comes time? Do they cut welfare? Do they cut programs like community centers and that kind of stuff? No, they cut cops and fire. Then they come back and say, we need more taxes because we had to cut cops and fire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now hold on. Who are we kidding here? But one of the problems is that there is a kind of a tank mentality, if you will. The cars are sort of a protective screen, kind of. And they claim you can get get them. Well, you and I both know, being gun rights advocates, there's an old saying, when seconds count, the cops are only minutes away.
Right.
And that's just because there aren't enough of them. And their job is to be preventative insofar as being there.
Right, and that's not to be critical of police. No. That's just to be honest about the way the reality is.
The fact is, you get dispatched, it's going to take time to get there. And the average call time is in big cities is long, 10, 20 minutes sometimes.
Can be, yes.
Instead of, we've got guys like a mayor of a big city, de Blasio, mm-hmm. who was agitating, giving anti-cop speeches, and all of a sudden, two of his men in blue get shot. They were assassinated. The guy who did it was a
made no bones. He was doing exactly that.
He was out to murder two cops, and you've got other people who come out after the murders and say the problem is those two guys weren't white. Now there's a racial element involved in this. And there was another guy who was arrested who was going to do the same thing, and he said, "Nope, they killed two non-whites. That's wrong. It should have been white cops." Mm-hmm. Okay, you've got to now. Does de Blasio suddenly realize that maybe he went too far? Well, obviously, when your entire police force, you show up 2 hours late to the wake for the two cops who got shot, mm-hmm. and the entire police force turns their back on you while you're giving a eulogy, you got an issue. And you got an issue that's not going to go away. And that's one of the things I'm looking at for this coming year. by the time people hear this show, it will be Saturday, obviously.
Yes, it will.
And we'll know if there were any disruptions on New Year's Eve, which is exactly what the anti-police protesters are talking about doing. They're talking about, they're essentially currently inciting riot. I'll be quite honest. I think Eric Holder incited riot. I think a number of Justice Department officials incited riot and a number, even mayors.
Yes.
Of Ferguson basically allowed riot to happen. I know what they wanted to do. They wanted to burn off tension. The problem being, Barry, that when you're in a poor neighborhood and you burn out all the businesses, all you have to do is go up to Euclid Avenue in Cleveland and see what happened to those businesses that were burned out in 1968. Mm-hmm. Guess what? They're still burned out because nobody's going to come back into a neighborhood where they're going to be robbed. They're taking a chance on being shot. Why would a businessman do business in a neighborhood where he's going to be burned out? Now, you also had to illustrate what one of the problems was. You had guys like Oath Keepers, and if you don't know who Oath Keepers is, they are usually retired military and police and fire and law enforcement and that kind of thing, who took an oath to the Constitution of the United States and believe in following that oath, hence the name Oath Keepers. And what they are involved in is gun rights and stepping in when the police won't do their job. And that most police won't do their job because they've been ordered not to by police chiefs who, by the way, in case you didn't know this, are political players.
Yes, they can be.
Police chiefs are political appointees who, tend toward the liberal. Not all of them, but a large number of them. You have to have higher degrees in police education, to get there. Now, that being said, in Ferguson, the businesses that weren't burned, Oath Keepers showed up and walked the roofs, and they were armed.
Yes.
And made it clear that anyone who made an aggressive move towards one of those businesses was facing the possibility of surrendering their hold on life or limb. No other way to put it. There was a threat implied.
My guess is they're pretty good shots, so it probably wasn't limb.
Yeah, yeah.
It wouldn't have been shoot
Nobody's
the wound.
Targeting arms or legs.
Wouldn't have been shoot the wound at that point.
No, and in fact, I just took CCW, and the first thing they say is don't shoot at legs and arms, shoot at the trunk.
Yeah, exactly.
You're wasting your time shooting at legs, arms, and head. But that being said, the Oath Keepers were there. Now, what happened after the Oath Keepers refused to let those businesses burn? They were ordered to by the police to remove themselves from the situation. Now, what does that say? That says we want these places burned too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I see a big conflict coming in the next year. Mm-hmm. I would look for what in 1968, I was 11 years old, what we called the long, hot summer.
Yes.
Now, the timing's a little different because 68 was an election year. 67 was pretty bad. 68, all that really didn't calm down until Kent State in 1970. And what did that take?
Well, exactly. But, you know, and Chuck, this is that old theory in sociology called the broken window theory.
The broken window theory, yeah.
I mean, it's playing out in New York right now. Matter of fact, today's in the New York Post. There's an article about how cops in New York City are actually intentionally turning away from and not dealing with some minor crimes that are happening in the city. Chuck, when does a minor crime become a major crime?
Yeah.
When you either encourage it or
ignore it
or tolerate it. You know, okay, well, then let me get away with that. I'll try to get away with something even bigger. This is a big problem. Broken window theory. I think this is part of our 2015 predictions. If we don't have, and I applaud folks who went out over this last weekend and turned up for these rallies to support police officers. Oh, there was a big one in Cleveland. You know, there were big ones all over the country. People getting out there to support the police officers. And that's fine, too, because, like I said, the vast majority of them are very worthy of support and respect and because they're responsible and they're doing a job to serve their fellow man and their communities. That's great. But I think what we're going to have a problem with is if the police can't do their job for fear of a public relations nightmare or this retaliation from a faceless, nameless mass of vigilantes, then pretty soon places like New York City and Cleveland and other places are going to be too dangerous to live or conduct a business in. I mean,
right.
I think you're looking at Ferguson. If it hadn't been for the Oath Keepers, the police in Ferguson were not stopping people from torching and breaking and looting these. I mean, they were making some arrests, but by and large, they were shackled themselves. Now, we don't want to err to the other side of that coin and say that, well, because they have a badge and a gun, then you have no civil rights whatsoever.
They have
whatsoever.
Free reign, yeah.
You know, you have no right to life or anything else. So that is its own problem. But the broken window theory, if we allow this to continue on as a society, what we're saying is that we have fully succumbed to an evolutionary mindset.
Yes.
Survival of the fittest and might makes right. Oh, okay. We're cops with guns, but you can get a mass together and shoot us in our cars and assassinate us. And you ever see the what was the name of the movie? I forget with Daniel Day-Lewis. It was about New York City in the 1800s when the gangs.
Yeah.
Gangs of New York. That was it. Sorry, I was having trouble drawing that. You're looking at the 21st century version of Gangs of New York.
You know what's ironic about that? New York has probably the most restrictive gun control law in the country. You know where that came from? It came from the gangs of New York who basically bought some politicians to outlaw the carrying of firearms.
Because by the regular
citizenry. By the regular citizenry. Because they knew then that the criminals who were basically had owned these politicians knew that the only guys who would have guns would be them. And guess what? In New York, that's what you have.
Mm-hmm.
In Missouri, you have Oath Keepers who basically say, you're not burning this place down. We've had, I don't know how many cases recently where people are breaking into homes. We had a case in Dayton, apparently while I was on vacation. I went to Williamsburg the week before Christmas, but we had a case where somebody showed up in a mall in Dayton some young men who wanted to buy some Air Jordans and didn't get them, and so followed people out in the parking lot and brandished a weapon in order to steal the Air Jordans that these people had just bought. And the people who had just bought them, one of them was CCW and killed the kid who brandished the firearm. Yeah, so this is the kind of thing we're starting to see. We are noticing, you know, the actual violent crime statistics are way down since so many states have allowed concealed carry. Now, what's the reason for that? You know, the old argument is that, well, you need to let the police do that. The problem is, Barry, you know, there's an old kind of a joke. It's a bumper sticker. Why don't you let the police do this job? And he said, because a gun weighs about 4 pounds and a policeman weighs over 200.
That's right.
So he's a little harder to carry around. And, you know, I'm not advocating shoot 'em up.
Right.
But I am advocating protecting yourself. And in so many of these cases, especially with home invasions that we're hearing about, people are coming in with the intent of stealing everything and killing you because that you can testify against them. And so
right.
You're kind of stuck.
It is a problem. Chuck, you know, that's one of the things I think that we have to be careful of in 2015, because I think we can have bad reactions on both sides of that coin.
Yeah.
I think we can go too far to the one direction of authoritarianism and say that, right. Say that, you know, we have to give all police, you know, have to do is show a badge and they can do whatever they feel like. On the other side of that coin is the idea of, well, I get a free pass to do whatever I feel like because I'm in a distressed group.
Yeah, right. There is a middle ground to be plowed, and it's really kind of wide. This is what disturbs me about some people that we're allied with, in that they want a knee jerk into the police side, and a lot of the libertarians that we're hooked up with want a knee jerk into the anarchy side.
Yes,
and it's sort of like they really are called the thin blue line for a reason. Now, does that mean that somebody can pull me over and just say, you know, I need to have a look through your car? Well, my reply is, respectfully, you're going to have to get some paperwork to do that. Some of our friends have actually said, well, if you aren't doing anything wrong, you have nothing to fear. No, that's wrong. What I have to fear is the fact that suddenly the procedure is wiped out.
Exactly.
And that's where the danger lies. You surrender too much of your rights to the police and to, quote unquote, the authorities. And that's where we really are with airline security, and have been since 2001. Mm-hmm. We've surrendered way too much authority. I mean, why am I a threat for carrying a penknife on a plane? The answer is I'm not.
No, because you'll fall asleep as soon as you sit in the chair. Yeah, you're no threat. I mean, I get that.
The fact is, I would be a boon, because if something bad happened on a plane with a hijacker,
mm-hmm.
I'd be the first guy to respond.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the other thing, too. We have to be careful, you know, not to go over individual, because I've heard a lot. You hear a lot from people who get frustrated. And when they get frustrated because things seem to be going out of control and they don't feel they can trust anybody anymore, they automatically start talking in what I would call apocalyptic tones.
Yes, yes.
And so that's the third side of this coin. It's a funny looking coin now, isn't it?
Three-sided coin.
And that's the idea. And again, and it's based on a faulty worldview that things are getting worse and worse. When actuality, things really aren't getting worse. We're just seeing more of what's been going on for a long time, because we now are in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week news cycle where people are jacked in, by a touch of their thumb on a smartphone or on a laptop, you know, we're sitting here using all these devices, or by, you know, cable or satellite news coming in at all hours of the day and night, we're seeing more. It seems yes. like it's getting worse. No, it's not. It's just that it's getting more exposure. And the key, Chuck, that I think a lot of people forget, and this is one of the things I want to leave people with as we talk today, is that remember, the more something is exposed to the light, the quicker it can get fixed.
Well, what happens, too, when you turn the light on? The cockroaches scatter.
The cockroaches scatter. Yeah. And they always say sunlight's the best disinfectant, right?
Yes.
The more light we're putting on this, the more you're seeing these things, the more you want to take, we want to fix the problems. Now, our problem is with our generally zombie culture, the response is just to shamble off and turn away from it and figure out it's somebody else's problem to fix.
Right.
But it's our problem to fix. No, that doesn't mean we all pack up and go to Ferguson, Missouri with sidearms no. and or I can't breathe t-shirts on at basketball games, okay? That's not the we're not fixing a problem there. Our problem, the way we fix the problem is inside our own person first. It's a heart fix. We don't do it. Christ does it. And then we submit. Yes, and I'm talking about lordship salvation, so okay, everybody yeah. get upset at me. Then we submit to the lordship of Christ in all areas of our lives, and we understand that he is Lord of all of our lives. He's Lord of how we look at law enforcement. He's Lord at how we look at ethnic relations. He's the Lord of how we deal with disparities in our social structure. But the only way we can really understand that and do that is stop just looking at the newspaper or your smartphone 24/7 to get your input and start looking at his word. And then use his word to look at those other things. It's like when we're sitting here talking about, you know, Ferguson, well, let's look back. Like I said, Michael Brown was probably a poster child for the self-esteem movement. Was Michael Brown a human being who was created in the image of God after his likeness? You bet.
Yeah.
Was Michael Brown a son of our first father, Adam, and who was imbued with original sin to the point where, I think it's in Jeremiah, it says, the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked and without excuse. Who can know it? Yes, absolutely. Could he fix that problem? Could schools fix that problem? Could the society fix those problems? No. There's only one place to fix those problems, and that is at the foot of the cross. That's what it's going to take to fix these problems in our society. The question is, are we as Christian believers going to start fixing the problem? Or are we going to be zombie observers on the sidelines watching the problems develop and going tisk, tisk, tisk about it and waiting for somebody else to provide the solutions?
It's interesting you bring up that zombie thing because that if you look at that very closely, you're looking at a sort of a Gnostic way of looking at the world. And by Gnosticism, there are a select chosen few who've been allowed to survive. Everyone else, the vast majority, are these brain dead brain eaters who have gotten this disease, and we're the only clean ones left.
I was trying not to be too graphic in our descriptions.
Well, I'm not going to describe. I personally can't stand those shows.
Oh, so. I can't either. And this is, as a kid growing up, like feeding myself on those kind of things and the old monster magazines and watching the slasher flicks and the horror movies. That partially explains the way I am today.
Well, Chiller Theater was I used to love Friday night double chiller nights.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right there with you.
Most of the movies were so cheesy, you'd be like, that was it.
Yeah,
that
but every once in a while they had a really good
one. Oh, yeah, there'd be a goodie. that is the people who look at themselves and sort of put themselves in the place of, who do they put themselves in? The place of the zombies? No, they put themselves in the place of the people who are fighting the zombies, the heroes, the set apart, the chosen, the elect, if you will.
Sure.
Nobody wants to be, you know, the zombie. The problem is that we are living in an age when, and by the way, thanks to our smartphones, one of the reasons that the abuses of authority are coming to the forefront is because it's a two-touch thing to turn on your camera.
That's right.
You activate your smartphone, turn on the camera, and very often, what do the police do? You'll need to turn that off. Well, I'm not going to be turning this off.
Exactly.
What are you afraid of? Well, what he's afraid of is doing something wrong and getting sued for it. And the fact is that he should look at that and say, you know, okay, that's going to make me a better cop. But a lot of them don't like it. And they will, in fact, order you to do it and then charge you, attempt to charge you with disorderly conduct because he refused a quote-unquote lawful order. That's why a lot of people are knee-jerking back toward the anarchist position. It's the wrong position to take. The correct position to take is, okay, I'm filing a complaint with the police department. I want these guys trained so they understand that you can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the attitude should be. I don't want the cops gone. I want them properly trained. And I want them properly trained in my constitutional rights. There's nothing dangerous about me waving a phone around. And there's nothing illegal about me recording our transaction. In fact, I like this idea. The one thing that I think that the liberals are correct about on a lot of these Ferguson-type situations is telling the cops they have to start wearing body cameras. I can't think of anything better.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a fantastic idea.
And one of the problems they've run into in the past is cops who have car cameras that are supposed to be on whenever they make a stop. And the tapes disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, we took that tape out to review it and lost it. Yeah. Sure you did. Same. Of course you did. There have been cops who have been caught trading favors for speeding tickets.
Yes, you see those every once in a while in the news as well.
There was a famous case down in Nashville.
Yes, I remember seeing that.
We won't bring up what he traded, but the fact is that it was a trade, and he tried to wipe out the evidence. And somebody found it. Somebody was able to recover the evidence after it was erased. So that's a good thing. That, in fact, I would encourage you, record if you get stopped, record it. It's good for the cops.
Absolutely.
And it's good for liberty.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't suggest going into a libertarian stance and cursing at the policeman and being as disrespectful as possible. All you're doing is poking the bear.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a job to do. Chances are he thought you did something wrong, and you need to find out what you did wrong so that you can not do it again.
No, that's true. Now, you know, Chuck, another thing, looking backward, looking forward, 2014 was a year when the United States Supreme Court interjected itself in a weird way, but interjected itself in a number of states in whether or not they had the right to define what marriage was, and basically told the voters that there really is no popular sovereignty anymore. It's a sovereignty, a tyranny of a Democratic minority who can basically decide for an entire state full of people what they will and will not put up with. 2015 looks to be interesting because after 2014's rulings, you now have the case that we talked about on this program before coming up to the United States Supreme Court for their spring term. That is coming from Ohio, which actually went 180 degrees the other direction on this whole issue about same-sex couplings. I won't even call it marriage because it's not.
It's mirage, as Doug Wilson calls it, mirage.
And I'll tell you something right now. That particular interest group and their fellow travelers are very worried, and we catch this because you catch these snippets out here. This is one I wanted to chat. I don't know if you have this up or not. You probably don't. But this is one. This just happened here over the weekend on MSNBC. they were doing a year in review, just like we're doing now. with one of their talking heads by the name of Chris Hayes. They've got a show called All In with Chris Hayes. Well, he had a guest on, and that guest basically is very much in the camp of, you know, homosexual rights activism, and had basically said that supporters of traditional marriage were no better than ISIS militants. Okay, we've heard that. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
It used to be the Taliban and Al Qaeda, and yeah, it's a horrible straw man. Well, Chris Hayes couldn't leave that alone, Chuck, and so he decided to go ahead and throw the Trump card, and that's the reason why I think I'm saying that the left is awfully nervous about what may be happening, because right now they're trying to cede the ground. And his guest said that there was a consensus in America that's pro-homosexual marriage. I'm not sure what he's thinking when the Supreme Court forces homosexual marriage rights on a number of states. That isn't a consensus.
No.
That's a tyranny. But if you look at polling among the American population, it's still not acceptable for a majority of the American population. But Hayes had to jump in, and he said this, and I quote, "Yes, I know, exactly," agreeing with his guest. "It has become an indicator of moral depravity." Now, he's talking on the other side of the coin,
sure.
Chuck. The persecution of gay people, you notice the little flip he does now, has now become a human rights violation and an indicator of moral depravity for people that conservatives want you to hate. In other words, he's saying it's an indicator of moral depravity to support traditional marriage. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
The left is, again, my maxim number one of all politics states, the left will always outrun their cover.
Right.
Chris Hayes just picked up the flagstaff and is out in front of the...
Oh, way out front.
Out in front of the band, running as fast as he can down the street. Problem is, he's outrun his cover. The persecution... Okay, show me persecution of gay people.
Not allowing...
Institutionally or... By a state in the United States, okay? Because that's what we're talking about, state actors. Let's look at persecution of gay people. Not the pretend persecution of, oh, you didn't rent an apartment to me because you didn't like the fact that I have a homosexual lover. Forget that noise. Because then we're also dealing with an issue of private property rights and person's right to do what they want to with their own property. But I'm talking real. Let's talk about the persecution that happens when you're a preacher and you're in a country and they throw you in prison and beat you and torture you because you hold up the name of Christ in a Muslim country. Let's also look at those who are thrown in jail and their children are taken away from them because they choose to home educate their children instead of handing them over to a state actor, as in Germany. You want persecution? Chris Hayes, you don't know what persecution is. Sit down and shut up, boy. I'm really frustrated with these type of people. And for him to say that an indicator of moral depravity is supporting traditional marriage, first of all, I just want to say thank you. I'm glad you put it out there, because now you've created a rallying cry for people to understand what the real goal
right.
of the homosexual you rights know, movement
there,
is.
There's a good 15 or 20 minute discussion on the presuppositions that underlie that argument for the 1 minute that we have left in the show.
Well, that's next week. And we will come back to this next week.
Yes. Okay. We'll try to do that if we already remember. We never remember to do that, though. That's the bad part. But there is a great underlying idea in there. And what is morality based on? I'm guessing that Mr. Hayes' worldview is such that there really isn't any basis for morality. It's whatever basically the quote-unquote majority of people. In other words, he has a libertarian view of what constitutes morality.
Right.
So basically, you could say that by that particular argument that there was nothing wrong with what Hitler did in Germany, because absolutely the majority said, hey, Jews are subhuman, and therefore we can put them in ovens. you can see where that leads to major problems. And Mr. Hayes has a problem if he thinks that it's morally depraved to defend the institution of marriage. That being said, we are out of time for this week. Happy New Year. We'll be back with principles and policies next week. Again, Happy New Year, and we'll see you next week.